coming up at 10 o'clock, the Heather McCoy Show. Heather interviews LA Times sports writer Kevin Baxter, who will discuss the United States women's national team's lawsuit against the U.S. Soccer Federation seeking equal pay. At 11, Book Waves, 11:30, Words and Pictures with guest Dennis Kitchen. All this KBOO programming made possible by member support. We're going out to you via 90.7 and other frequencies on the FM band in Cascadia and via KBOO.FM to all the ships at sea.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Events Committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO is looking for a grant writer to join our team. We are seeking someone with a proven track record in writing successful, complex proposals for diverse sources of grant funding. Previous experience working in the philanthropic landscape of the Portland metro area is preferred, and previous experiences working with community media organizations and with communities of color are A+. This is a 1-year contract position for a total of 200 hours at $25 an hour. And the grant writer will work closely with the KBOO development director. For more information, go to our website at kboo.fm and click on the KBOO is hiring link on the right side of the home page.
The Heather McCoy Show.
And welcome to the Heather McCoy Show on KBOO Portland. Joining us later on in the hour will be Aaron Brown, the leader of No More Freeways PDX, to talk about the latest updates in their campaign against ODOT's proposed Rose Corridor expansion. Currently, we are joined by LA Times writer Kevin Baxter to talk about the current lawsuit that the members of the U.S. Women's National Team have brought against the U.S. Soccer Federation. Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on this morning. In this new lawsuit, which was filed on International Women's Day, all 28 members of the national team player pool are asking for compensation and working conditions equitable to their counterparts on the men's side. Is this lawsuit seeking compliance from their recent collective bargaining agreement that they just signed last year, or are these new claims?
These are new claims, and I find it very interesting because I thought we were done with that with the collective bargaining agreement was signed. The women were not ecstatic with the CBA. They got what they thought they could get, and they appeared at the time to be happy with it. They never did, my understanding is they never did drop the EEOC complaint when they signed the collective bargaining agreement. That was still valid. This lawsuit does sort of set that EEOC complaint aside. But it's interesting to me that they signed the collective bargaining agreement and then come back and sue the Federation again. It's the suit was filed in Los Angeles. There's a lot to dig into here with how the Federation is going to react, what the women are looking for. One thing that's interesting, too, is because I've covered a lot of teams over the years in a lot of different sports, I have never, ever seen a team as united as the U.S. women's soccer team. And going back to even 2007, they do put up a very, very strong collective front, and they are a formidable ally in this kind of stuff. The other thing before we move on, it's important to note that what the U.S. women are doing has a ripple effect worldwide. they were really, the U.S. women and the Australian women after 2015 were the first to sort of take collective action against their federations, demanding that women get treated better and get treated equally to men. And since then, we have seen women in Denmark, Norway, France, Spain, Brazil, Puerto Rico. It spread to the U.S. women's national ice hockey team, the WNBA. They're all taking their cue, I think, with U.S. women's national team, with women in this country, to say, hey, we're good. You know, we deserve to be treated equally to the men.
Yeah, that is an important point. I know in Spain they had a soccer coach who was abusive and just basically would not, basically the Spanish Federation would not get rid of him.
Correct. And then we had the situation in Denmark where the women decided to boycott a qualifying event. We had in Norway, the best player in the world, Anna Hedberg, decided that at 23, she's no longer going to play for her national team because of the way the federation treats women there. If the Puerto Rican team actually, after kickoff, were friendly against Argentina in front of the largest crowd in Puerto Rican history, they just stopped playing. They lined up along the sideline, cupped their hands to the crowd, and the gesture was meant to say, are you going to listen to us now? Then the Argentine women stopped playing as well. They didn't join the protest, but they could have run down and kicked in as many goals as they wanted. They did not. They stopped in solidarity with the Puerto Rican women to sort of support them.
Why does this new lawsuit in the EEOC complaint that they had fired previously? I didn't quite understand that.
Excuse me. Why did that get?
I'm sorry. Why does this new lawsuit in the EEOC complaint that they had filed previously?
Well, my understanding is and I haven't spoken to lawyers exactly on that topic, but that because both are federal actions, one is a lawsuit, one is a claim, because they're both in federal court, that one supersedes the other. So the EEOC, and many of the same charges are in this. It's interesting, though, that U.S. Soccer says, when you talk about the collective bargaining agreement, U.S. Soccer says a lot of these things, they claim, U.S. Soccer does, a lot of these things have been addressed. And they look at the lawsuit and say some of the charges in the lawsuit, for example, the lawsuit says the men have played one of their last 49 friendlies in the U.S., domestic friendlies, on artificial turf. Women have played 16% of their games on artificial turf. They said that ended in 2017, and that, in fact, the men are the most that have more recently played on artificial turf than the women. They talk about the per diems now are much more equal. They talk about the women are flying charter flights more frequently. A lot of those things that are in the lawsuit, U.S. soccer claims, have already been addressed. That may or may not be true. I mean, certainly they are playing less games on artificial turf. They did fly charter during the World Cup qualifying, but I find it hard to believe that all 28 women would sign on to this lawsuit if there wasn't something there. One of the big issues in talking to U.S. soccer is not so much the disparity on the national team level, but how that is impacted by the disparity in professional sports. And by that, U.S. soccer is saying, look, the women want health insurance. If somebody gets hurt, they want to guarantee that they get their yearly salary. And U.S. soccer says, we don't do that for the men. Why should we do that for the women? If the women want parity, why are they asking for something the men don't get? Well, the reason is, if Alex Morgan gets hurt, her national women's soccer league salary may not be paid. It's not guaranteed. If Josie Altidore gets hurt, the Toronto FC pays his salary. If Josie Altidore gets hurt, MLS gives him health insurance for his rehab. Not necessarily in the National Women's Soccer League, or some of the women go to play overseas, and there's other rules. So the men have a built-in advantage that they get, you know, in some cases, multi-million dollar salaries playing for their club team. The women don't have that. The men get health insurance and other benefits through their club teams. The women don't get that. So in a sense, the vacuum created by the lack of resources in the professional league is split over into this lawsuit where the 28 most elite women in the country are asking for some guarantees that if they get hurt or something happens to them, that for at least a year their salary will be paid, and that's not an issue on the men's side.
Yeah, and here locally, Tobin Heath and Lindsay Horan are two thorns that are local in Portland that are subsidized by the U.S. Soccer Federation for their participation in the Portland Thorns.
Right, and that's another claim that the Federation makes. It shouldn't say a claim. That's another point that they make, is that U.S. soccer is subsidizing the women's league. There wouldn't be a women's league without the support of U.S. soccer, and that's true as well. It seems as if there are, you know, I don't want to make a political issue out of this, but because it does seem that there are good arguments on both sides, but at the end of the day, you have some of the most elite athletes in the world who are just looking for a little bit of reward, you know, for their toil, for their dedication, for their talent. They have decided that U.S. soccer is responsible, you know, to step up to the plate. U.S. soccer is saying, look, we're doing what we can. We're subsidizing your league. We don't give the men that, and the women are, you know, rightly saying, well, the men don't need that. You know, we need a little bit more of a helping hand.
Compare and contrast the kind of accomplishments of the U.S. women's national team versus the men teams as far as on the field and off the field accomplishments.
Well, that's an interesting point, and that's clearly where the women are on the strongest ground. You know, the women are three-time world champions. That's a record. No other team has won three World Cups. The men have not got past the quarterfinals since 1930. The women, ranked number one in the world, have been, for the most part, since the FIFA rankings started more than a decade ago. The men have never been ranked higher than, I think, fourth, and that was just for a very short period about 15 years ago. So there really is no comparison. And then when you know, another thing, interesting thing is U.S. soccer wants to go back and say, look, a lot of these claims made in the lawsuit are old claims. Well, let's just look at the last 3 months. The men have played two friendlies in the U.S. this year. The women have played three games. The women have outdrawn the men. The lowest women's crowd is higher than the best men's crowd this year. The largest domestic TV audience for a soccer game in the U.S. Was the Women's World Cup final in 2015, 27.1 million people. So they draw eyeballs to the TV set. They draw butts into the seats at games. Think about the TV commercials you've seen for Gatorade and other products that feature women players. Have you ever seen a men's player on a national commercial? I can't remember one where I've seen, there was the one in Mexico with Landon Donovan, and there was an insurance commercial with Landon Donovan not long ago. Landon Donovan's no longer on the team. You know, the active women are still, you know, desired by advertisers and sponsors. So there does seem to be a difference. Now, what some people come back and say is, well, look, the FIFA Men's World Cup, which the U.S. did not qualify for in Russia. In 2014, the last time the men played in that, FIFA generated $4 billion in revenue, and the men got, you know, over $10 million for making it to the round of 16. The women got $2 million for winning in 2015. That was their share of the FIFA prize purse. The entire Women's World Cup generated about $73 million in income. So, yeah, you're comparing apples to oranges, but here's where I think that analysis falls short. All that money that comes into the U.S. Federation goes into one pot. FIFA does not say, here's money from the Men's World Cup, it has to be spent only on men. That money goes into a pot, and it's used for youth development, it's used to pay executives, it's used for travel, it's used for sponsorship programs, it's used for all kinds of different things. It goes into one pot. And so here's the argument. If you're saying the men generated more income because men's soccer is more popular globally, then the men should get more money and should get the benefit of that. That's not necessarily true. Think about a car dealer or a car manufacturer. They have two production lines, one making small compact cars and one making luxury cars. The guys on the assembly line making the luxury cars, they generate more income for the company, right? The luxury cars are going to sell at a higher price. But everyone on both production lines gets paid the same because they work for the same company. I think this is the woman's argument. Look, we're part of U.S. soccer. We excel. We should be paid at least what the men want, at least what the men get, because we're both part of the same team.
Last year, Hope Solo ran a campaign for the presidency of the U.S. Soccer Federation. Her insurgent campaign brought up the shady practices of what Soccer United Marketing, known as SUM, which is a commercial rights partnership with U.S. Soccer and MLS team owners. How likely is this lawsuit going to address some of the issues that Hope first raised in her campaign for the presidency?
Well, Hope's campaign was tragically flawed, I think, from the start. She did raise some good issues, but they were raised in such sort of kind of a ham-handed way. that I don't know that a lot of them gained traction. However, she did push some of the candidates to the left, if you want to speak in political terms, made them a little bit more progressive and made them see things a little bit more of a progressive way, so that it has created some problems for the current leadership of U.S. soccer. And by that I mean two of the leading candidates in that election were Kathy Carter, who was the president of SOM, and Carlos Cordero, the vice president of U.S. soccer at the time, and Carlos Cordero won. Both candidates during their campaigns made very strong statements about how the women's team, Carlos Cordero, if I remember correctly, said deserve more respect, and Kathy Carter talked about how they have to be treated equally. Now that might have been campaign rhetoric, but the fact is, they said it on the record, Carlos Cordero won the presidency. Now the women have actually come back and they've used those quotes, and they've said to Carlos Cordero, okay, you want to treat us with more respect? Now you're the guy in charge. Let's see you treat us with some more respect. Let's step up to the plate and get some of this done. So in that sense, the issues that Hope Sola raised are still resonating now, because now Carlos Cordero finds himself sort of in a tough spot. He needs to fulfill what he said that he would do, but a lot of people in U.S. soccer are pushing back on that, which is why we have a lawsuit.
This lawsuit is happening at an interesting time in sports. As a culture, we are in a post-Me Too movement, which is taking women's rights claims more seriously, but we're also within a time where the strongest players' union in sports, MLBPA, is having issues within the parameters of their collective bargaining agreement, since almost no team wanted to sign marquee free agents Bryce Harper nor Manny Machado this offseason. Plus all the court Trump appointees, how do you think this will play out in a court of law?
Well, the timing is very interesting, and U.S. soccer makes that point too. Coming 3 months before the World Cup, the Women's World Cup, where the U.S. will go in as favorites again. It's interesting because what U.S. soccer says is the media spotlight is on them. No one that I've heard from the women's team has even any mention that there may be some sort of a boycott or job action ahead of the World Cup. They're all intending to go and continue to train and practice and play in the World Cup, so they're not going to use this lawsuit as a way, they're not going to use the World Cup as a way to bargain for attention on this lawsuit. But the fact of the matter is, the women are talking about it. It will be an issue. And you're right, it comes up during the Me Too movement. But in addition to that, women's soccer is really catching on now, and I think this really strengthens the women's hand. It used to be the U.S. was far and away above the rest of the world, and it was hard for the women to make much of an argument, because the response would be, well, look how you guys are treated compared to the rest of the world. Look at the advantages you have compared to women's soccer players in other parts of the world. That's no longer the case. You look at Mexico last year, the fledgling women's soccer league in Mexico, they had 5 games that drew more than 30,000 fans. That's incredible. There were 2 games in Spain just last month, one that drew 42,000, another that drew over 20,000. We talk about the job accidents in different countries. The Irish team boycotted the training camp. The Brazilian team boycotted the training camp. We talk about Denmark boycotting the game. This is a growing movement, and now that I think the U.S. women can say, this is not an isolated incident. This is part of a growing movement, whether it's the Me Too movement, whether it's soccer teams in other countries, whether it's the U.S. women's national ice hockey team, they're saying that these are issues that are now global. We are part of a larger movement. This isn't just an isolated thing.
Wrapping up, moving to on the field, what was your impression of the team during its most recent She Believes tournament?
I think there are some chinks in the armor, frankly. I think that this is a team that is incredibly talented, maybe the best team ever, and compared to some of the teams in the past, how good they were. And by that, I mean, if you put this team, on the field against, say, the 99ers, I think this team is a better team. However, the rest of the world has really, really come up. And, they had that 28-game unbeaten streak that was ended in France. The French team looks really good. They're going to be playing the World Cup at home. I actually was just in France last month and talked to some people with the federation, talked to some women on the team, and they've already circled that quarterfinal. If everything goes according to plan, the U.S. will meet France in the quarterfinal in Paris at Parc des Princes, and the women in France are already looking forward to that match, and the people of France, that stadium will be rocking for that game. this is not a coronation like it has been in the past for U.S. women's team. This is going to be a very tough tournament. Now, if they get past France, I think they should have a lot of confidence, because if they get past France, likely waiting for them would be Germany and England, some other teams they've done very well against. The French team, which beat them 3-1, is going to be the one that they're pointing toward. And remember, the U.S. is also coming off that failure in the Olympics in Brazil. So this isn't the dominant women's team that we've seen in the past. It may, in fact, as I said, be the most talented women's team, but the rest of the world is really caught up. There are some great women's soccer being played in Europe and elsewhere. This will be by far the most difficult tournament that women have ever played in. And if you bought a ticket to the final, as many Americans did, I was told by someone in France that when the tickets for the final went on sale, something like a quarter to a third of the tickets went to people from the U.S. If you bought a ticket to the final, you may wind up seeing some other teams there.
Oh, yeah. In 2015, I felt one of the only reasons they made it to the final was Germany and France just beat the crap out of each other in Montreal.
French should have won that game, by the way. And, you know, you guys in Portland have somebody else to watch, too. Christine Sinclair is probably going to break Abby Wambach's all-time scoring record. And people talk about that all-time scoring record for women's soccer. No, for men's, women's, aliens, anybody. No one has scored more goals in international soccer than Abby Wambach did. Nobody, male or female, and Christine Sinclair is going to break that record this summer.
Yeah. One last question before you take off. Why is Mallory Pugh in the midfield?
Jill Ellis is doing a lot of interesting things. Some of it is working, such as putting Crystal Dunn at an outside back. Some of it maybe not so much. I stopped criticizing Jill Ellis. This may be a controversial comment, but I think Jill Ellis is great, and I am actually going to write a story here in a couple of weeks talking about why can't Jill Ellis coach a men's team. I mean, we've seen men coach women's teams in every sport, and we've started to see a few women like Becky Hammon and others making noise in men's professional sports as assistant coaches in the NFL and Becky Hammon in the NBA. Why can't Jill Ellis coach a men's team? I mean, I think she is a borderline genius. Some of the stuff that she does to be successful, the way she got in Carly Lloyd's head at the last World Cup, the way that she sort of held her back until the knockout round started and then unleashed her, I thought was brilliant. Some of the things she does may look a little daft at first, but they tend to work out if you just give them some time. So I'm on the Jill Ellis bandwagon. I may be totally wrong, but as long as she keeps winning, I'm on her side.
That sounds good. I've been talking with the writer Kevin Baxter with the LA Times. Thanks for joining us on the show, and we'll hopefully have you back. Are you assigned to the World Cup in 2015?
Yes, I will be going. Been doing a lot of stuff leading up to it as well, talking to some of the 99ers. Remember, this is the 20th anniversary of that team. By the way, when you talk about Mallory Pugh in the midfield, my bigger question is, why is Megan Klingenberg not on the team? She is my all-time favorite woman soccer player. And I just want her to go to France just because I want to hang around with her. So let's start a movement to get her put back on the team.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for being on the show this morning.
Thanks for the call.
Okay, this is the Heather McCoy Show.
Supergirl. Tu sors de ton
Austin Maurice
et te déhanches comme une actrice. Ta petite Miniche
Armani
et tout ce qu'il y a de plus sexy. Hey Supergirl,
Supergirl.
Ton rouge à lèvres de
Lancaster
donne à ta belle bouche un mystère que je viendrai bien. Toi tu en resteras bouche bée. Tu n'auras plus besoin d'argent ni des vêtements élégants. Il te faudra de la souplesse, de l'audace, de l'adresse, de la tendresse de tigresse. Hey Supergirl, ton make-up de chez
Shiseido,
enveloppe jolie monte peau, ton parfum
or bleu de chez Guerlain
me fera perdre mon latin. Mais cette nuit, pas question de bonne éducation. Il te faudra de la souplesse, de l'audace, de l'adresse, de la tendresse de tigresse.
Welcome to the Heather McCoy Show. Joining me right now is Aaron Brown of No More Freeways PDX. He's here to provide an update on ODOT's proposed Rose Quarter freeway expansion. Welcome to the show, Aaron.
Just got to say, I've never had the fortune of having women's soccer be the lead-in. This is like the best episode of the best hour of radio that could not have been more my interests aligning. Fighting freeways and supporting gender parity in women's sports.
I sit with the Riveters, so if all anyone right. wants to see me during a Thorns game, that's usually where I'm at.
I will be looking for you come June once the stadium's complete.
Definitely. For listeners who may be unfamiliar with the ODOT proposal, can you give us an overall summary of the Rose City Quarter project?
Yes, sure. So the Oregon Department of Transportation is proposing to spend $500 million, at least $500 million, on a freeway expansion that would go on I-5 through the Rose Quarter, so between the Fremont Bridge and where past the Moda Center all the way to I-84. It's about 1.8 miles of additional lanes of freeway. ODOT's claiming that this project will lower traffic congestion, will improve air quality, and will reduce carbon emissions. And we just want to be emphatically clear, that is something that a freeway expansion has never done in the history of freeway expansions anywhere in North America. So these are very dubious claims, and we are the community groups that are opposing it because, you know, it's expanding into the backyard of Harriet Tubman Middle School. They are literally moving the lanes of freeway that already, this middle school already has some of the worst air quality in the state. These students are at risk for high rates of asthma, mm-hmm. for diabetes, for cardiac diseases and stuff. And so there's a huge environmental justice issue about this, in particular because the Tubman school is 40% black, and there's a large vulnerable population there at the school. And they're a frontline community. So in various ways, like, this case really represents sort of a Mad Libs of, like, the sort of thing that we should not be doing in Portland, right? Like, expanding freeways when we have 11 years to solve climate change, 40% of our carbon emissions come from transportation. So our campaign has been, for about the last year and a half, organizing environmentalists, public health experts, social justice folks, transportation geeks, neighborhood associations, local businesses, anyone and everyone that agrees that we should be spending our money on alternatives instead of freeway expansion.
I read an article recently about basically Houston has 26 lanes worth of freeway and they're still stuck. So explain the concept of induced demand, because I don't think that gets said enough.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to do so. It's very counterintuitive, because I certainly empathize. I'm sure many people listening to KBOO right now are stuck in some traffic jam at some point or wishing some car would get out of their way. Freeway expansion has never solved traffic congestion. This is completely counterintuitive, I know, but if you think about it, if you happen to have a ice cream shop right across the street from your house versus a couple blocks away versus 5 miles away, the distance to it really changes probably how much ice cream you're going to have. Mm-hmm. And if you were to have a direct highway connecting you to a freeway that was 5 miles away to this ice cream shop, you'd be more likely to drive on it. And that's what we're ultimately getting at. When we provide infrastructure that makes traveling in a particular manner particularly free and particularly easy and heavily, heavily subsidized, the way that we subsidize oil and automobiles and freeways through all of these sort of choices, you're just encouraging more people to drive. And so as the Portland region continues to grow and as we have more and more people moving, we have these questions of what is their geographic... There are spatial limitations. It logistically... Geometrically, it is impossible for all of the new people moving here to all choose to take an automobile for the trip that they're using. And we cannot expand enough lanes of freeway to meet that demand. Every additional lane of freeway will just be filled up with another group of people saying, oh, I guess I'll drive to the Lloyd Center at 4 p.m. today, right during rush hour traffic. At a certain point, you just eventually have paved over your entire city and turned it into nothing but one giant freeway that's still stuck in traffic.
And that's not an inviting environment for pedestrians or bikes at that point.
It has enormous public health consequences, both from a traffic safety perspective, from a air quality perspective. And once again, 40% of our carbon emissions are coming from transportation. It's the only sector in Oregon where emissions are increasing. Every other sector, you know, we have plans to build solar plants and you know, get rid of coal and stuff. But at the fundamental level of transportation, it takes so much energy, even in some bizarre world where, like, some Bernie Sanders, Elon Musk thing happens, where, like, every American family is given an electric vehicle.
Uh-huh.
The amount of energy it would take to move 60 people via 60 cars versus 60 people in 2 to 3 buses, it's still an enormous amount of energy that if we're going to hit our climate goals, we're not at a point yet where we can produce that much energy from clean sources.
Yeah, and then the other thing with electric cars is that people don't mention is because of their battery weight, they're heavier, and so they're having more weight to slow down, and so they actually cause more pollution in terms of PM10.
Electric vehicles are a important and necessary, but merely one piece of the puzzle of solving our transportation carbon emissions picture. Like every automobile we need to have electrified, and we also just need to be driving less. We should be doing that for a myriad of public health and social justice initiatives completely unrelated to climate. But when we put in the like 11 years to solve climate change before, you know, we have to be completely off carbon by 2030 if we want to avoid more than 2 degrees Celsius. And that's the like, we're still flooding major islands and stuff's really getting bad, but you know, we can still sort of feed most of the planet. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking like really dire stuff, right?
Yeah.
And so from that context, why is it that the city of Portland, which is known for our environmental values and our good urban planning and all of these things, wants to spend $500 million on a freeway expansion that we're going to be stuck with for the rest of our lives, right? This is an intergenerational investment that you're planning for the next decades and decades. And we're really going to say, knowing what we know now, that we spent this on fossil fuel infrastructure instead of public transit or biking and walking, making other, you know, dense walkable communities connected by public transit.
And those communities are, on the whole, better for mental health as well.
Emphatically so, right. Just, you know, what we can do to encourage people to live in communities where they can intergenerationally, like people can live closer to each other. You know, I grew up in the suburbs here in Portland. It's really difficult when you reach a certain age, whether you're too young, whether you're too old and you're unable to drive, whether you can afford an automobile, whether there's questions of citizenship. I know there's a bill going through the legislature right now, but if you're not a citizen, you can't get a driver's license here in Oregon. Like, those are systemic major mobility challenges that have enormous material impacts on people's daily and emotional and public health on their well-being.
Yeah.
Right.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Aaron Brown from No More Freeways PDX. Our number is 503-231-8187. It may not sound like it, but I'm a little bit under the weather today. I had a major bike fall, and so I'm a little bit dizzy as well. So your comments and questions are very much welcomed. The phone number again is 503-231-8187. And in case you're wondering, I do plan on going to urgent care right after the show. Since our last conversation, since your last appearance on the show, there has been a public hearing that was held at the Oregon Convention Center on the project. What was the outcome of that meeting?
ODOT had to sit and listen to 2 hours of testimony from middle school students asking about air quality and asking about climate change. And, you know, I was really satisfied and really humbled by the turnout from the community. It was really thrilling to just and cathartic to watch so many different people from so many places, some of whom had never testified in public before, others of whom had helped kill the Mount Hood Freeway here in Portland, you know, decades and decades ago. Really an intergenerational group of folks that came together to stick up for the, you know, we had an amazing teacher from Harriet Tubman who came and was speaking about his experiences of how his students, you know, had been screwed over by a lot of systemic racism by both Portland Public Schools and the Oregon Department of Transportation, and to say, you know, of course, this freeway expansion is happening in this school, in this background. Like, uh-huh. And this, my students, we ask them, like, you know, how do you want to be part of this? Do you want to fight this? And they're like, well, they won't listen to us. Like, there's entire generations, you know, and he concluded with talking about Black Lives Matter and Black Lungs Matter and really, like, trying to reemphasize that this is a perpetuation of the same racial injustices that built this freeway through Portland's only Black neighborhood back in the 60s and 70s. Here we are 50 years later, the same thing is happening, just to, you know, make it easier for trucks. And it won't even make it easier for trucks. The only policy that's ever solved freeway expansion is congestion pricing.
We have a caller on the line. Her
Excellent.
Name is Sarah. Welcome to the Heather McCoy Show.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Sarah.
I'm great. One, I hope that you're not getting Aaron sick because he's doing so much important work in our community. And I hope you feel better really soon.
Yeah, thank you.
So get to urgent care, please. Yeah, my name's Sarah Iannarone, and I've been an active participant of the No More Freeways Coalition, and I just wanted to call in and ask Aaron, while he had all these amazing KBOO listeners on the line, you know, what do you see as this freeway discussion really takes us back to the 60s and 70s, these pivotal times when we made some critical decisions about Portland's future in terms of environmentalism, and so many communities of color were left out of that conversation and even hindered by it. But now we have an opportunity to do that again in a much better way, where we understand both how to have an effective grassroots environmental movement and what it means to have those movements led by communities of color. So maybe, Aaron, would you comment a little bit about how you see this freeway fight, which is really intense and challenging time for Portland, as a great opportunity for us as we move into the future? And I can take my answer off the air.
Can I add one more thing? When you mentioned the Mount Hood freeway, Aaron, earlier, was that the freeway that basically was defeated and then that gave birth to the MAX line, essentially?
Yes. Wow. Thank you very much for calling, Sarah. I mean, and Heather, yes, you know your stuff. So in Portland, we had this really wild thing that happened in the 70s, where there was sort of a generational shift, and we elected a whole bunch of younger folks that said, you know, every other city in America is moving in this suburbanization in all of these directions. They're disinvesting from their downtown. And Portland was also unique in cities in America in that comparatively, like, our African-American population was small. Portland and Oregon largely were very homogenous and white. And I do not say that as good things as much as just accurately describing sort of where this energy was. And it led to, you know, stopping building a freeway through what is now Southeast Clinton, right? Like, this is a neighborhood that has $700,000 homes and bikes on every block. It was originally going to be a freeway expansion. And the community groups were able to come together and stop it in the same way they were able to tear out the freeway that was on Harbor Drive that is now the Tom McCall Waterfront Park. But I really appreciate Sarah's question, and I know this is something Sarah's been working on quite a bit over the past couple weeks. It's sort of this question of, well, how do we channel that energy that was really thoughtful and really cogent and deliberate and, like, let's use community planning to really think about what our neighborhoods should look like? But Oregon is a lot more diverse, and we are a lot more heterogeneous, and we have these, you know, not identity politics in a bad way, but I mean it in the most, like, the questions of urban planning and what our communities look like as a collective, how we determine this sort of stuff. It's a lot harder when we have such enormous wealth disparity. It's a lot harder to have conversations where tenants aren't given the same space at a neighborhood association meeting, where certain community groups are struggling just to put food on the plate, let alone to, like, come to their PTA meeting, let alone to come to the additional meeting where the PTA is fighting against a freeway expansion that won't be in the neighborhood for another couple of years, but it's still part of this systemic screwed upness, right?
Yeah.
So if you look, I think what Sarah's getting at is, you know, we've had some really exciting successes here in Portland, like the Portland Clean Energy Fund last year. Like, what an enormously monumental moment in which, like, the environmental advocates and the communities of color, the frontline groups, the economic justice groups all lined up and said, we're going to take on the big business in Portland, and we're going to, like, tax the Comcasts and the Walmart type entities, and we're going to put that money towards, you know, jobs for weatherization and for, you know, creating economic opportunities to be climate resilient. That is the Green New Deal before the Green New Deal as a concept was officially, like, announced and proposed, right?
Yeah.
And so in that framework of, well, what are these community groups? How do we organize for the infrastructure that matters, right? That's another question. Like, not only is it great that, I think it's incredibly encouraging and amazing to see, like, the Clean Energy Fund and some of these new, like, energies taking off. But in the 21st century, it's not just about the new coalitions you build. It's also about the coalitions and infrastructures you retire. And that question of how we move in that direction of, like, we don't need prisons anymore. We don't need freeways anymore. We certainly don't need more of them. And we don't need more pipelines and landfills.
One aspect I read of the, basically the environmental summary, is that they had an environmental justice section. And it was a kind of a weird thing where they just had, it was basically an oral history, like a questionnaire of different community stakeholders that are within the Rose Quarter. And it does not hold back about what happened there in the 1950s as far as urban renewal in the historical African-American part of town. However, there does just seem to be a disassociation with the new injustice that ODOT is trying to impose on the area. They don't bring up the Harriet Tubman Middle School once. What are your thoughts on the environmental justice part of the report?
So I will say that ODOT is acutely conscious of the history of this neighborhood, and they are doing their best with the way that they doing their best to sell this project based on what are the talking points that they think that concerned Portlanders care about. So there's a ton of talk about how it's flashy and excellent for biking and walking, and it's this, you know, reducing congestion, and there's this whole additional thing about you know, it's a restorative justice for the neighborhood. Like, we're reconnecting the community by putting this additional, there's a new bike bridge coming, right? like the bike and ped, the major bike and ped organizations, Oregon Walks, the Community Cycling Center, the Street Trust, the city's Bicycle Advisory Committee, the city's Pedestrian Advisory Committee have all either come out in opposition or writing strongly worded letters articulating all of the problems with this. But back to your, sorry, to your question about the environmental justice, you know, the Harriet Tubman PTSA has come out in opposition. We're working with a handful of other groups of longtime folks that are in that neighborhood. The Elliott Neighborhood Association there is in opposition to this project. If you were to really do something that would be, you know, there's this amazing Albina vision coming forth, right? Like, so Rekia Adams and some folks are saying, what would it look like to turn that section of town into a dense new Pearl District-esque space that was predominantly for a right to return for the African-American community that got, and by Pearl District, I mean in form, not in, in what
in
businesses
practice.
And people that are there,
yeah.
Right. But a neighborhood that had, you know, a ton of affordable housing that was transit-oriented, that, that had parks, that had green space. And there's simply no way in which you can do that while you're also putting a freeway through this neighborhood. The ODOT has these proposed plans to put lids, like these caps on the freeway.
Yeah.
But they're not strong enough to be buildable, meaning you can't put a like 8-story building on top of it full of housing. And frankly, ODOT is not exactly in the business of making like pedestrian, walking friendly, comfortable spaces that you want to actually go sit and have a cup of coffee on, right? Like, I for one think the new dumbbell buildings and stuff that are down here by the Burnside Bridgehead are actually kind of charming and interesting to look at, but there's so many lanes of traffic on MLK and Grand and Burnside and Cooch that if you actually get your cup of coffee at Cup and Bar, sitting outside is not actually that pleasant. Like, you can have density and have urbanization, but if you don't have public space that's not allocated to automobiles, you don't have a city.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, what does it look like for us to build on those caps that ODOT is talking about? Instead of expanding the freeway, what would it look like if that neighborhood on top of the freeway was actually given the opportunity to really be cultivated into something meaningful?
Well, the other interesting about thing about the Environmental Justice Report is a large part of the community that they interviewed basically saw biking as something that young white professionals did and that not necessarily part of their community. And so it feels like in addition to having more freeway hoisted on them, it feels like the bike thing is kind of negative for them as well. Did you see that part of the report as well? Or
yeah, and I say this as a young white guy that lived in a gentrified part of that corner of North Portland for 7-8 years before I moved farther north.
Yeah.
In Portland, we absolutely need to have an honest conversation about race, and frankly, the bicycle advocacy universe is doing a lot of work in the last decade to really like take a step back and really think about a lot of our assumptions about who bikes and why and what infrastructure and resources we need to get more people involved with bikes. And you know, some of the long timers in that neighborhood rolling their eyes at bike lanes, like I disagree with sort of their assessment, but I completely am empathetic with where they're coming from, and I think that there's an honest way that we can have a conversation of like, how do we build a neighborhood that still recognizes, you know, the folks that have been here through all the times when this neighborhood was not what it is today. But with that said, like, the freeway expansion is literally poisoning the community, right? like arsenic and cadmium, like things, diesel, like the stuff that comes out of here, like is carcinogens. Like this gives people cancer. And if we, you know, that's out of a Ray Bradbury novel to ask that students can't have outdoor recess, right?
Yeah.
Like that is profoundly messed up. And I'm conscious that I have FCC regulations about the words I would rather use to describe the circumstance, but I'm all for having a restorative justice vision of what this neighborhood looks like. It's emphatically impossible to imagine one in which fossil fuel infrastructure being expanded into the backyard of a middle school that can like give kids cancer and asthma is the way to move forward with it.
I don't know if you saw the tweet, but Don Jr. Doesn't know how air can be racist.
How air can be racist.
Yes.
Right.
He's not a very bright kid. So he's like an adult son.
Just as a complete aside,
yeah.
Donald Trump talking to one of his associates like, oh, well, my son's kind of a moron. Imagine having your dad finding that out like in a court disposition that like your dad doesn't think much of you. Like,
that's got to hurt. We have Cornelius. He's on line one. Welcome to the Heather McCoy Show.
Hey, thank you. So when I looked at the original expansion plan, well, I don't know if it was the original, but when I originally looked at it, I should say, I didn't see anything in this downtown expansion that includes anything about the interstate bridge being expanded, which to me is just like, all we're going to do is widen the bottle downtown to get choked up at the bottleneck at the interstate bridge again.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's your question? Just how are the projects related?
question is there any, like, I didn't see anything with relying on the expansion of the Interstate Bridge in this downtown expansion project. It's like, why are they treating the two projects as independent and not necessarily something that needs to go together?
So that's a great question, and I think what's interesting is that as far as we can tell, let me first take a step back. They released the environmental assessment on February 15th. We sent them a letter on March 4th that said, you're missing numerous data sets, right? Like, you put out this fancy brochure, there's hundreds of pages of drawings and schematics and stuff, but your entire assertions about how traffic emissions, or how carbon emissions, traffic congestion, and air quality were going to improve are based on data sets that you don't even provide. Like, it's this equivalent of in middle school, like, taking a math test and not showing your math on long division. Like, the teacher has the right to be like, you know, show your work, otherwise I'm assuming that you're kind of fibbing or used a calculator, right?
Right.
So we didn't get that data from ODOT until yesterday. So we are only have 18 days left in our 45-day public comment period, and our traffic engineers are actually going through those numbers and really trying to independently verify, like, ODOT's findings. And one of the things that we think is the case is they are basing their traffic projections on the assumption that there is some massive freeway expansion with the Columbia River Crossing 2.0 coming forward. Because in that context, a universe in which you made some giant bridge somewhere else and made it even easier for a large number of cars to come through, it increases the quote-unquote bottleneck feature of what's happening at this stretch of freeway. And therefore, by expanding the freeway, you are reducing the amount of hours and amount of automobiles that are idling right below the middle school. And like, that is how they are coming up with this assessment, that this project, they're saying that this project is necessary because all of these other projects, like the Columbia River Crossing 2.0 Interstate Bridge, are necessary. So they're saying if we spend $500 million on this project, we need to do so because we're about to go spend $4 billion on some other project that's 2-3 miles away. My answer to your question is we have to be investing in transit. We absolutely should be finding a way to address congestion on this corridor. We need to be providing alternatives so that folks that live in Vancouver, especially, you know, low-income folks that are commuting into town, whatever it is. But 40% of the Clark County commuters who work in Portland make over six figures. That is an enormous, and 85% are white. Those stats are incredibly different from the community around Harriet Tubman. So the question of who's breathing that air versus who's driving through this neighborhood, there's an environmental and mobility justice question to that, right? And we should absolutely be building transit that makes it easier for folks in Clark County to get to job centers in Portland and vice versa. But freeway expansion will not be that answer. And we need to be thinking about that. And environmentalists, frankly, need to be paying attention to whatever the 2.0 conversation is of the Columbia River crossing, because allowing our governments to spend billions on a freeway expansion when we have 11 years to solve climate change is climate denialism, flat out. And how we address that will really say a lot about, like, what kind of leaders we have. I mean, the state of Washington has their governor running for president on a climate change platform, and he's about to sign a bill that would raise a carbon tax to build more freeways in metropolitan Seattle. You might as well put that money towards a coal plant, right? Like, you know, what is the point of a carbon tax if you're building more carbon-producing infrastructure, right?
Yeah. The one thing I wanted to discuss is that you were talking about how most of the people that are going to be commuting from down from Vancouver and Clark County are over $100,000 or more. That's almost like, you know, 1950s urban renewal, where the freeway was put there originally so that white commuters can get there to the suburbs and back without living in downtown. So it feels like a historical racism is being continued with this project.
You know, this might be unfair, but I think it's worth noting that, you know, we had 50-some people come speak in opposition to the project at the hearing on Tuesday. We had like 5 to 6 people that spoke in support. And one of the people that spoke in support said, no, this is a good project. This isn't a freeway widening. It's an urban renewal project.
Oh.
Like, and someone wrote, included that phrase in a letter to the Oregonian last week as well. And I was like, how oblivious? I mean, you know, it is an enormous position of privilege to be oblivious to the fact that calling something an urban renewal project, that's showing your cards unintentionally about, like, how you think government agencies are meaningfully engaging and planning in marginalized and historically disenfranchised communities.
And the other thing about you were mentioning about the Columbia River crossing, like, I can see the need for a new bridge because obviously as much as the 405 in LA sucks, they don't have a river crossing where the whole traffic stops for a boat. I can see like having a higher grade separation on that, but you have to include like the yellow or gold line with that as well. And that's one part that Washington doesn't seem to want to accommodate.
Right. And it will be interesting to see over the next couple of years how Washington state's politics have changed. Washington, in particular, some of the exurban parts of Clark County were opposed to the light rail project, and when they had a majority of Republicans in Olympia in their state, they helped kill the project for that reason. But we need to address the bridge having a lift is bad. You know, the fact that we don't have sales tax means, and the way the bridge itself is designed. And I want to come back to talk about the Rose Quarter, but just yep. But they are related. They are absolutely part of the same idea that ODOT still is part. There's a freeway industrial complex that sees there's still a couple $1 billion worth of freeways to wring out of the Portland region. They're using this outdated understanding of mobility of freight, like freight's got to get through. It's this Portland stoplight. You know, congestion pricing would actually fix this problem. If we had a sales tax in Oregon, which I'm not advocating for, but just as a point of order,
yeah,
that is an enormous reason why folks in Clark County are driving in, and therefore, because of the way that bridge is designed, where there's all these on-ramps right off to Jansen Beach, they're going to all of those big box stores there, and that creates all the on-ramp and off-ramp merging is an enormous part of what that congestion is.
And I can't say much more because a job is involved with it, but I see the tax dodging firsthand. Let's just say that.
Yeah.
We have a caller. Author is on line one. Welcome to the show. Clementine, is author there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, you're here. Okay.
Good morning.
What was your question?
Well, I was at the meeting last night, and I was one among the few who testified in support of the project. And I don't just, you know, wildly make a claim that this project is so worth doing that there's some kind of ulterior motive behind my interest. I'm a transportation specialist, and I live in the area, and I've seen it turn into a land of parking lots and junk food drive-throughs and car dealers, and I want to see it develop into a real district. More than just the barren wasteland it is now. And I pointed out the improvements that it would make to the pedestrian environment and the ability for bicycles to get across the river and around that area and to slow down traffic and to make traffic safer. And I tried to do it as best I could. And you know, I'm taking this opportunity to make the same case that it is a worthy project. It is.
I'm from Orange County, California. When you have wide freeways, that is a barren wasteland. That's just my personal input.
Well, and I'll respond directly. Arthur, I appreciate you calling in, and I'm happy to have a good faith conversation with you on this. This project, ODOT has gone bending over backwards to frame it as a transportation improvement project. It's not a freeway widening. We're spending half of the money's going to bike ped projects, right? Like, they're talking on and on and on about how they're improving. Yeah, and ODOT's messaging is they're deliberately, they're bike washing as opposed to greenwashing it, right?
So
let me respond to your claims.
I live right there. I see the traffic back up all day long on that intersection, and that basic improvement will get traffic through smoother, less frustratingly for motorists, and they won't have to drive as recklessly. It should be a safety improvement. Yes.
So Arthur, let me respond to your claims. Arthur,
go ahead.
There is a enormous data set that ODOT's findings as to whether traffic would be reduced on this corridor has just been made available. We are having our own independent civil engineer folks with degrees and letters behind their name that are actually going through those findings and independently verifying them. We are finding out that ODOT is wildly miscalculating their impressions that traffic will be improved. There's two different questions
here.
One is, no, Arthur, I'm speaking.
It seems obvious to me that traffic will be improved and congestion will go down and air pollution will also improve.
Why would a freeway expansion improve air quality and air pollution?
You're inviting more cars.
and allowing the cars that now use the road in the supporting this project to be able to get through more smoothly and not have to accelerate and stop and go and create as much pollution. It should reduce the air pollution in the district.
Yes. So, Arthur, that's your point of view, and the Neighbors for Clean Air, the like statewide air quality advocacy organization, came and testified in opposition, and middle school students and their teachers who complained about, you know, frequently lose... One guy spoke about how his wife, who was a teacher there, had lost the sense of smell because she had been in that building for so long, and the air quality there was so terrible that, you know, folks are having meaningful, like, corporal impacts from the air quality of being in that neighborhood. And I'm also going to point out, as it relates to the bike and pedestrian stuff in the neighborhood, the Oregon Walks, the pedestrian advocacy organization... All of the bike ped organizations that have looked over this plan, many of whom had stayed neutral until they actually saw the plan, said, this is not worth $500 million. Like, we are opposing this because we do not believe that the actual bike ped plans in the neighborhood are an improvement. There's an enormous traffic safety question about this.
Yes,
there hasn't been a single traffic fatality on this stretch of freeway in over a decade. Meaning, while there was a 16-year-old kid who was hit and nearly killed walking across 82nd Avenue, which is a street that ODOT owns, ODOT does not have the money to invest in these other streets, but they do have money on a freeway expansion.
So we're going to agree to disagree there. One last thing, we're going to try to get to Andres really fast. He's on hold. But Oregon Public Broadcasting quoted a Portland commissioner saying, as much as I'd like to spend $500 million elsewhere, she's unable to because it's, quote, ODOT's money. The money is coming from a HB 2017 that the Oregon legislature passed in 2017. Is there possible to put pressure on the state government to break up this funding into block grants so the city of Portland can determine where to spend it?
Yes. The answer is Commissioner Udaly has been a very sympathetic and we've been grateful for her collaboration. We're going to continue to work with her on this. She's incorrect that this money could be reallocated elsewhere. It's just a question of political will.
Yeah. Andreas, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, you're quite welcome. We're very short on time.
I have a couple of things to address. One, I drive from Portland to Seattle all the time, and bottlenecks in the freeway systems that take down freeway systems from like five lanes or four lanes to two lanes really do constrict the traffic, and there should be something that should be done about that. My main point was more so improvement of mass transit and from Clark County, especially down to downtown, because I see this all the time crossing into Washington, where there's this like single person car. And they're all Washington plates, and they're all people that work downtown that live in Vancouver, like you guys addressed, that make, you know, five figures, six figures, and these are all the people that voted down the Old Columbia Crossing improvement because it included mass transit. And how are you going to get these people? How are you going to reconcile that? How are you going to get these people that make this much money and convince them that they should be riding the MAX when they absolutely refuse to have it in their neighborhood?
That's a great question. I'll just sum it up by saying that, you know, we don't have to get every single person on the MAX. We just have to get more of them, right? And by that, I mean, some people are always going to choose to drive. And frankly, like, I live in St. John's now, and when I come to the Heather McCoy Show here in KBOO downtown, sometimes I'm biking, sometimes I take the bus, and if I've got a bunch of stuff I'm carrying with me, I'm going to drive. And which is to say that I would rather pay a couple bucks as congestion pricing to drive and have a freeway without congestion when I need it, if it means that I'm getting a bus that arrives every 5 minutes. And to your answer, I would say some of the folks that live in exurban Clark County may never drive, but if we have a bus that gets to downtown Vancouver every 5 minutes, like, there's a bunch of housing in downtown Vancouver now. There are parts of Vancouver that are dense enough to support transit, and we have to be, like, encouraging that as the built form that gets people to take transit more.
But the Columbia River Crossing, the old one was rejected because of the MAX crossing, and it's like, you're going to have to convince them to include mass transit on this bridge. So you're not going to have to convince a few of them to ride the mass transit. You're going to have to convince them to pony up money to help pay for this crossing that includes a MAX or some kind of mass transit lane that most of them won't ride, so they'll reject it again.
Well, Oregon rejected it because they wouldn't have the transit.
The toll bridge.
Yeah. The toll bridge would do it too. This has been the Heather McCoy Show. My guest has been...
Aaron Brown. Real quick, nomorefreewayspdx.com/public comment. Please submit your public comment in opposition to the Rose Quarter Freeway fossil fuel infrastructure.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll see you next Thursday.
KBU at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month, we'll screen the documentary film Circle of Poison on Thursday, March 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. Once a pesticide is banned in the United States for its dangerous health and environmental effects, companies are still permitted to manufacture it for export only. Circle of Poison documents the export of dangerous pesticides and the inspiring ways communities are fighting back. Again, that's Circle of Poison on Thursday, March 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners.